about the humanitarian catastrophe in the enclave. Hamas has rejected Western claims that it violated human rights during its Saturday operation against Israel. Group says it only targeted military forces. And more pro-Palestinian solidarity marches have been held around the world as Israeli attacks on the Gaza Strip continue to claim innocent lives. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Israeli warplanes have targeted yet another residential building in northern Gaza as the regime's deadly onslaught on the besieged Palestinian territory enters its sixth day. At least 44 people were killed and dozens injured in the strike on the building in the city of Jabalia. Meanwhile, emergency workers in Gaza pulled the bodies of 18 people from the rubble of two shattered homes in Khan Yunis in southern Gaza. Palestinian Health Ministry says the death toll has risen to over 1,400, with more than 6,200 wounded since Israel began pounding Gaza on Saturday. It says most of the casualties are women and children. According to the UN, some 340,000 Gazans have been displaced. Brazil, which currently holds the rotating presidency of the UN Security Council, called a meeting of the body on Friday to discuss the ongoing Israeli-Palestinian conflict. The International Committee of the Red Cross has warned that hospitals in Gaza are turning into graveyards after equipment stopped working due to a lack of power supply. The humanitarian organization says power cuts have put at risk the lives of newborns in incubators, elderly patients on oxygen, patients on dialysis, and others. The ICRC says all 13 hospitals in Gaza are only partially operational because of severe shortages of fuel and crucial medical supplies. Hospitals across Gaza are reeling from a shortage of staff and supply, while the number of critically injured is growing due to indiscriminate Israeli bombardment. On Wednesday, Gaza's sole power plant ran out of fuel and shut down after Israel's decision to cut off supplies. Three of the five water plants in Gaza are also out of service. The Israeli bombardment has leveled 1,000 homes since Saturday, and many in Gaza face dire shortages of water, fuel, and medical supplies. Palestinian resistance groups launch more rockets toward the occupied territories as the Israeli death toll rises to 1,300. The Hamas resistance movement says the rockets were fired toward Tel Aviv in response to the killing of civilians in Gaza. According to Israeli media, multiple rockets fell in northern Israel, including Netanya and Hadera. Southern Israeli towns of Ashkelon and Ashdod have also been targeted. Sirens also sounded in the city of Sderot. The retaliatory operations come as Israel has been massing its troops and tanks near the Gaza fence and are getting ready for a ground invasion. Israel has used international banned white phosphorus bombs in its strikes in Gaza's Karama neighborhood. Over 2 million Palestinians are trapped in the Gaza Strip, which is known as the world's biggest open-air prison. Hamas has dismissed Western criticism that it violated human rights in the Saturday operation that caught Israel flat-footed. The resistance group says the sole targets were Israeli military forces. Saleh al-Aruri, deputy head of the Hamas Political Bureau, said the Al-Qassam Brigade's attack was an organized operation that targeted the Israeli military's Gaza division. He said hundreds of resistance forces managed to dismantle that division within just 3 hours. He said Hamas did not target unarmed Israelis, but Palestinian civilians who used the opportunity to enter the Israeli-occupied territories clashed with settlers and killed a number of them. Haruri said Hamas does not see an outcome for the ongoing battle except victory. The Hamas officials said the West accuses Palestinians of committing crimes against humanity, but it ignores Israel's appalling record of targeting civilians. More pro-Palestinian solidarity marches have been held around the world as Israeli attacks on the Gaza Strip continue to claim innocent lives. Thousands of protesters hit the streets of Jordan's capital, Amman, demanding the government to end its relations with Israel and to expel the regime's ambassador. In Chicago, protesters condemned Israeli aggression against the Palestinians and chanted anti-Israeli slogans. The outpouring of anger against the occupying regime also fueled rallies in South Africa cities. A large number of people protested outside of the U.S. consulate in Johannesburg, criticizing Israel for what they called oppression of Palestinians. Also in Cape Town, people expressed outrage at Israeli bombings of Gaza, calling for the liberation of Palestine. Israel is expanding its campaign of airstrikes, this time targeting Syria. It has attacked two Syrian airports, putting them out of service. Israeli airstrikes hit Damascus and Aleppo airports. Syrian media say that air defenses were activated to confront the strikes. No casualties have been reported in Aleppo, and in Damascus, there has been no information on the impact of the strikes. In recent years, Israel has conducted hundreds of airstrikes on the Syrian territory, targeting the army positions and other areas. Israel's recent airstrikes come in the wake of the regime's incessant bombardment of the besieged Gaza Strip. The strikes have led to the grounding of flights at the two airports. Israel rarely comments on strikes it carries out on Syria. Let's get some analysis into the picture here. Saad Nimr is a professor of political science joining us from Birzeit University, who joins us from occupied Ramallah. Welcome. And also Susanna Khalil is a researcher, columnist, and activist who joins us from Montreal. Welcome to you both. Saad Nimr, first over to you. So we're looking at the mere fact that you have an operation that's being executed by Israel, of which it is nothing short than a massacre that's taking place in front of the eyes of the international community, where perhaps like no other time in the history, you have an entity by the name of Israel that comes out and says, I'm going to commit war crimes. I'm going to cut off food, electricity, gas to the besieged people there in the Gaza Strip, with the aim of that would be to starve them, which ultimately would lead to their deaths. And yet you have like the U.S. Stating we're out there to support you. How does that make you feel, knowing that Palestinians are getting massacred that way in the form and manner that it's happening?
Well, you know, the situation is really, you know, sad about the international community. Israel today declared officially the war, and Netanyahu and the Knesset declared the war. And it hasn't happened since 1973. All the wars that Israel after 73 they did, it was only, you know, they call it operations, but now they call it a war. And that to get the legitimization of using an excessive force against the Palestinians. What is going on today in Gaza, it's not a war, it's a war crimes only, not war, it's war crimes, what the Israelis are doing. Now, the support by the United States is absolutely, we do know that the United States is supporting Israel all the time, and they even exceeded this time by giving them a kind of a green line to go ahead. Not only that, but also willing to shut up anyone in Europe or anywhere else who dare to criticize Israel in this respect. So they give them, you know, like an open hand in doing whatever they want to do. And hence the Israeli statement saying that we are dealing with animals and we are going to cut the electricity, the water, and the food and the medicine. And that's exactly what Gaza today is suffering from, lack of all these. Today, the electricity is finished. That's it. No more electricity now in Gaza, because whatever left of fuel yesterday, it's just finished. And now we are concerned about hospitals who have not only no electricity and no water, and also no medical supplies, which they urgently need. And also the citizens of Gaza, whoever left in Gaza, they are also asking for water to drink. There is no drinking water even. So the situation is really, really very, very bad. Now, what about the international community regarding this? They are, you know, supporting Israel, and the claim usually that the United States is using, that Israel have the right to defend itself. Okay. Now, please, someone just explain to us as Palestinians, how could the occupier have the right to defend itself? They are occupation. They are the one who is doing the atrocities from the very beginning. They are the one who attacked us in Palestine. And they now have the right to defend themselves. The occupier have the right. If someone attack you at home, and you can't do anything about him, and he have the right to defend himself, and you don't have that right. So this is absolutely something we can't, you know, even tolerate anymore with this Hippocratic international community. Today, what we are trying to do is to be in contact with all grassroots organizations and grassroots movements around the world, our friends and those who could understand or understand the Palestinian question, to stand by and to go into demonstrations, try to pressurize their own government to make some changes. Now, after almost a week of the Israeli bombardments to Gaza, we started to hear few voices, very, very, if you like, shy voices from Europeans saying, well, yeah, you can't cut the electricity and the water. There are some, you know, humanistic aspects that you have to monitor. But the Israeli, they don't care, and they are going to go ahead in this unless there is really a stand by the international community to say, stop. This is, you can't go ahead with that any longer, because what you are doing is not a war. And let's ask this question. Israel usually say that we have targets. Where their targets? They are not targeting anyone of the resistance. They are targeting only the civilians. They are bombarding the homes and the buildings and bring it down on the heads of the people who are living there without any regret and without any even blemish. They don't care, even if more and more Palestinians. And this is the aim. From their point of view, they wanted to reach a high number of casualties among the Palestinians just to justify their failure in front of their own people, and to say, see, now we retaliated. You know, just justify their failure in security, failure, their army failure, and all the response failure in Israel after the operation on Saturday. So they will put it now against the Palestinian citizens and the civilians in this way, to just to get justification and to get a kind of satisfaction for this government that they are doing something about what's going on after Saturday.
Sana Khalil, when we take a look at some of the way that the media is covering this, I don't know if you agree or not, we're looking at how the emotional compassion is being skewed and amplified so much so towards the Israeli narrative, where there needs to be now compassion for Israel, who is now a victim. That's how the line is being towed at this point. And so much so, and in such extreme ways is that being done, that it's almost pointing to how it wants to erase perhaps the oppression that Palestinians have felt throughout the years and decades. Looking at some of the ways that, for example, Blinken's visit, the U.S. Secretary of State, coming out here and from what I'm reading here, shaking hands with some of the victims of what happened in the occupied territories. But this is more a political war at this point, don't you think, that this is something that has not been addressed? And it seems like Israel, with the support of the U.S. and Western countries like in Europe, want to basically have Israel push out the whole Palestinian factor in this. What's your view of how things are developing there, especially on the media side?
Yes, first of all, hello, and thanks for having me. And what did happen in the Palestinian native is nothing new. It started in 1948 when the colonial regime of Israel was imposed in Palestine from Europe by Europeans. What we call a state, what was imposed in 1948 from Europe, is a classic colonialism. We are in the 21st century, and we think and we feel even that the colonialism is something that is overcome, is over, is out of history. No, the colonialism is still exists alive in our time, and is this Israel that it was imposed in Palestine in 1948. That we have to take. I would like to take because this, I would like to talk about the Palestinian cause and the Palestinian tragedy. What is that? This is a conflict between a native against colonialism, against colonizer. We are in the 21st century, and we are still in this atrophy of colonialism, which is a shameful, which is the most retrograde situation in our time. That's the point that I would like always to talk about that. Because this is not a religious conflict. This is not it's not a human right. The violation of Palestinian human rights is because of the consequences of the violation of a political right of Palestinian as a native against this colonialism. Well, we have to make that clear, because it's not clear for the mass people. People think this is an ancient problem, that this is a religious problem, which is not the case. Still, we are talking in our modern time, with democratic value, but at the same time, we are still facing colonialism, which is the most retrograde, the misery of our history. We have to get rid of any colonialism, and that's the struggle that Palestinian native Samaite people are doing. So what has happened now in Palestine is nothing new, and what the colonial regime of Israel, they need to exterminate the Palestinian native. That's all they need, because the nightmare of this colonialism, it's not even the topographic, because they took all our land. They took all Palestine, all historical Palestine, they took it. And they want to take more from other country, but what they call the Great Israel. But the nightmare of the colonial regime of Israel is demographic, that they need to really to destroy, to exterminate this population. And they're going to do it. The colonial regime of Israel, they're gonna continue to do all the barbary, all the destruction against the Palestinian, because they have the support of Europe and United States. That's why. So that's why when we are struggling in a specific way, for example, BDS, it's forbidden. So that's why what is happening with Hamas, I think, is natural, and that is legitimate to defend themselves. By the way, to use the arm, a struggle, this is a international law according to Resolution 1930, which says that all people have the right to defend themselves against any foreign threat, which that's what is now is doing Hamas. So Palestinian, they have the risk to disappear, face this colonial fascist colonialism now.
And that is it for World News. It's bye-bye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. all produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Israeli officials have ordered a total blockade of the Gaza Strip to compensate for heavy losses suffered during Operation Al-Aqsa Storm, launched by the Palestinian resistance group Hamas on Saturday, 7th of October. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The website of Arab News has covered this story and tells us more. The Palestinian envoy to the United Nations has issued a vehement condemnation of the Israeli regime's underway indiscriminate war against the Gaza Strip and its threat to bring the entire coastal sliver under an all-out siege. Riyad Mansour wrote in a letter to the United Nations Security Council on Tuesday, 10th of October, "Such blatant dehumanization and attempts to bomb the people into submission, to use starvation as a method of warfare, and to eradicate their national existence are nothing less than genocidal." Riyad Mansour added, "These acts constitute war crimes by the Israeli regime." Calling up an unprecedented 300,000 reservists, the Israeli regime has declared a long war on Gaza in response to Operation Al-Aqsa Storm. Gaza's resistance movements initiated the operation on Saturday, 7th of October, in response to the occupying regime's decades-long campaign of bloodshed and destruction of Palestinians. The military campaign has seen the regime leveling entire districts and featured its using banned white phosphorus munitions against densely populated neighborhoods of Gaza. Earlier, the Israeli War Minister Yoav Gallant drew international condemnation by announcing a total blockade of Gaza to stop food and fuel from reaching the territory, home to 2.3 million Palestinians. The war minister, Yoav Gallant, also said Israel was battling a beastly people. The United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres on Monday, 9th of October, said he was deeply distressed by Israel's announcement of a complete siege of Gaza. Guterres said, "The humanitarian situation in Gaza was extremely dire before these hostilities, and now it will only deteriorate exponentially." Iran's press TV has also covered the same story and tells us more. Israeli officials have ordered a total blockade of Gaza to compensate for heavy losses suffered during Operation Al-Aqsa Storm, launched by the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas on Saturday, 7th of October. Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian has warned of a humanitarian catastrophe amid ongoing Israeli aggression on the besieged Gaza Strip, calling on the United Nations to adopt immediate measures to prevent the occupying regime from perpetrating further crimes and rights violations against Palestinians. Hossein Amir Abdollahian raised the alarm in a letter to United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres on Tuesday, 10th of October. In the letter, Amir Abdollahian pointed to the recent developments in Palestine and the Israeli regime's decades-long aggression against Palestinians. Amir Abdollahian touched on the plight and suffering of the Palestinian people at the hands of the illegal Zionist regime over the past seven decades. He blamed Western countries, particularly the United States of America, for the dire situation in Palestine today. The top Iranian diplomat said in the letter, "During the past seven decades, the occupying Zionist regime, without paying the slightest attention to the laws and norms of international law, including international humanitarian law and human rights, and whilst enjoying the support of the United States and the West, which protect this regime against any legal charges and punishment, has committed the most heinous war crimes, crimes against humanity, and the crime of genocide against the oppressed people of Palestine. Amir Abdullahian pointed to Operation Al-Aqsa Storm by the Palestinian resistance group Hamas, and he described the Hamas-led military action as a natural reaction of the Palestinian people in defense of their most basic rights. The Iranian foreign minister also underlined the Palestinians' right to self-defense against the occupying regime in accordance with the United Nations Charter and in accordance to international laws. Amir Abdullahian said, "The legitimate right to defense is an inherent right that is clearly recognized in the United Nations Charter and international law. The Palestinian nation, as a nation that has been unjustly deprived of the fundamental right to determine its own destiny and is exposed to attacks and violations of human rights and human dignity at any moment, unequivocally has the right to defend itself and resist occupation and aggression." In his letter to the United Nations chief, Hossein Amir Abdullahian warned about the indiscriminate killing of Palestinians by the Zionist regime in the battle against the Gaza Strip and raised the alarm about the dangers of laying a full siege around Gaza by cutting off water and electricity and humanitarian aid. Amir Abdullahian said, "With an overview of the inhumane actions and blatant threats of the Zionist regime in recent days, I deem it necessary to warn against the occurrence of a major humanitarian catastrophe in occupied Palestine and highlight the responsibility of the United Nations and the UN Secretary General to support the oppressed people of Palestine and to prevent the aggressor regime from continuing its violence, bloodshed and destruction."
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladheena amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri was salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now let's listen to Sheikh Salim Bimji.
My dear brothers and sisters in Iman, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. As we have been going through the theme of living the pure life, or living the life that Islam has envisioned us to live, we got to a point yesterday where we looked at the topic of community building. We want to move on from that point of last night and go on to our next discussion this evening. We've established a community, we have a center, we have programs, we have events, we have scholars that are with us on a regular basis. But what happens when that community is taken away from you? What happens when that community is literally stripped from under our feet overnight? So coming back to the topic that this global pandemic hit in March of 2020, and it upset the entire world. It changed the way that everybody did anything in life, from work to school to worship to everyday things like shopping. And when it happened, when it hit, and I'm going to only focus on the Muslim community, we really had three options, I would say, when you look at how religious, our community centers, our organizations across at least North America, I can speak about, or within Canada, we had a couple of options on what to do. We had one option, which was the default, which was to close all the centers immediately and do nothing. And I mean do nothing, that don't have any programming, even online. And unfortunately, this happened in many communities that I am aware of. They literally shut the doors of the center. They sent out an email, because of COVID, the center is closed until further notice. There will be no online programming. Basically, do what you want to do in terms of spirituality. communities that are, again, communities, I use that term loosely as we analyzed it last night in a bit of detail, but communities that are supposed to be providing the spiritual guidance through the scholars who I know were ready and willing and able to offer the guidance, we're basically told in many parts of our Muslim community that, look, there's a pandemic, we've closed the centers. Thank you, but your services are not needed right now until we figure things out. That is one option. And as I said, there are many communities that I'm aware of that took that route, that they basically just shut the system down, they shut the centers down, and they did nothing for the believers. And keep in mind that, as I said previously, that religion, one of the benefits of having a religion is to deal at times of adversity. If you don't have religion when you're facing in your most difficult times, what can you rely on? Right? We don't go to the liquor store. No, we go to the vicar store. And when the vicar store is closed, people end up going to drugs and alcohol. And this is not what the Muslims did, but there are people out there who could not cope with COVID and the new reality. And so they were engaged in, you know, drugs and alcohol because that was their coping mechanism. And unfortunately for many Muslims in the community, they did not have something to fall back on because, as I said, the centers had shut their doors. It was as if, you know, that you could not even do anything online because their COVID would be transmitted via Zoom or something. So that was one outcome that people had to face. Number two was, yes, we close all the centers, but we move our programming online as far as possible, the majalis, the dua sessions, because that was around the time of the month of Ramadan, of Rajab, Sha'ban, and Ramadan were coming up after COVID began. And so as we recall, some of our communities had the ability, some of the leadership had the foresight, the religious scholars were allowed to engage with the executive and said, let's move everything online. It's not the ideal situation, right? We still see that learning in person in this format, our children coming to madrasa with a teacher in front of them, our children going to the Muslim school with a real live teacher in front of them is the best way to learn. Even if you look at non-Muslims and the secularists, this is what they're saying, that children were not able to focus by looking at a teacher on a screen. They were not able to really take in the information. And obviously we know as believers that this medium that we have, that yes, majalis and du'as can be online, but ultimately the best way of learning is in a physical presence. And there are many things we cannot do in virtual. You know, I remember people were saying, can we start to pray Jamaat Salat online? I'll take my laptop and face it towards Qibla and I'll position myself, the imam will have a camera on him, the imam of Jamaat, and I'll pray right behind my laptop. It sounds strange, but people were doing it. I had somebody tell me for the namaz of Eid, the Eid al-Fitr that happened in that first year of COVID, that I'm going to pray behind my television. I've moved my 60-inch TV to face the direction of Qibla, and I'm praying behind it. I said, bro, you can't pray behind a television. You need to be praying with a real live person in front of you. But people thought that you could just, you know, because you can do a majlis online or a madrasa class online, well, why don't we just have Jamaat Namaz online? Some other Muslims are doing it. So why don't our maraj give a fatwa that you can pray Jamaat behind your television or your computer? It just doesn't work like that though, brothers and sisters. But again, those communities had that foresight to move online. Then there was a third option where you keep the masjid or the Husseiniya open and you defy government orders. You practice, you know, a form of rebellion, as some people in the Christian world said, well, the prophets of God were rebels. The prophets of God never submitted to a worldly government. So why as Shias are we submitting to the government of Canada? Forget about regulations of Health Canada and the local health authorities. We'll keep our centers open and defy the government rules. Now, we know that our maraja do give us rulings where they say that when you live in a non-Muslim society, that you need to follow the rules of the country. Obviously, where they do not impede us in fulfilling our obligations, Right? So if the government of Canada passes certain laws which infringe on our rights as Muslims, we believe that we don't follow those. But this was a unique situation because it's not wajib to come to a majlis, generally speaking. It may become wajib if there are deviancies and things happen in the community where now we need to keep majalis in person, or congregational prayers or Friday prayers, they may turn into a necessity where we have to have them. And I'm sure we remember the story of many churches in Canada. The pastors ended up going to jail. I know in Alberta, there was a few pastors in rural Alberta that went to jail because they refused to close their church. They practiced a form of, you know, of what they felt to be piety, and in confronting the government, saying that you don't have the liberty to come into my church and tell me what to do. Muslims, for the most part, I don't see that we did that, and maybe that was good, maybe that was bad. I'm not going to comment on that, but just to see that, you know, there were various voices out there that were doing different things within the pandemic to ensure that their community remained on the path of religion, and to ensure that their community remained on that path of piety. At the same time, you know, we had very strange events happening in the community. You know, I'm not going to go into the whole issue about the vaccinations and should you or shouldn't you take them and the boosters. That's up to you to decide. But there were strange things coming out of our Muslim community. There was a speaker, an orator, who said that the cure for COVID can be found in the Quran. Literally, he said the cure for COVID is in the Quran. What did he mean? He literally said, open up the Quran and you'll find a hair. You know, maybe you pray sometimes and a beard hair falls out, or our sisters are praying and one of their hair falls out. And he literally says, you take that hair, you put it in water, and you drink that water, and that's the cure for COVID. You won't get COVID ever. Don't worry about vaccinations and this and that. Take a hair, wash it, and drink that water. It sounds preposterous, but this was what some so-called scholars of our community were promoting as a cure and a protection from COVID. Right, and other things that came out, and I don't want to go through all of the theories, but there were many things that were being said in the community, right? And many of them perhaps even defied logic, if you think about it, right? Islam being a religion of logic, and our teachings being a religion based on intellect, many of the things being said really didn't make sense to most sane, able-minded individuals.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Adi Alimun Hali Hakimun Mati. شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمن
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz, every day from 15:20 to 16:20 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
The UK may block Assange's attendance at appeal to European Court of Human Rights. UK officials deny the case is about press freedom, and they won't say anything about whether Assange can go to France. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to Truthout, should he be deported from the UK, Julian Assange, the Australian publisher of WikiLeaks, faces up to 175 years in a US prison on charges related to his release of information that revealed US war crimes and torture. His legal team has stated that they plan to appeal the extradition case to the European Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg, France, arguing that the British litigation process has been rife with malpractice. However, experts say there is little likelihood that Assange, who is currently being detained without British charges at London's Belmarsh prison pending extradition, will be allowed to physically attend any ECHR hearings in Strasbourg, which lies in France's Alsace region. The UK authorities' case against Bale has always been that he is a significant flight risk and a reminder of his 7 years in the Ecuadorian embassy. Tim Dawson of the International Federation of Journalists, a group opposing Assange detention, told Truthout. He added, "I can see that they are going to allow anything similar to arise." One reason the British Home Office could be nervous about letting Assange attend hearings is that this flight could come in the form of an embarrassing asylum bid once Assange reaches French soil, a bid that would have significant credibility behind it, given that the United States government officials have already broken the publisher's attorney-client privilege and actively considered killing their would-be defendant, and given that the British legal process has included documented conflicts of interest. A British Home Office spokesperson declined to comment on whether Assange would be allowed to attend ECHR hearings, emphasizing that any appeal to the ECHR is still theoretical for now. Assange's legal team tried last year to appeal preemptively to the ECHR, but was told at the time that the British appeals process needed to be exhausted first, according to Kevin Gosler, who wrote a book on the case. He says that timeline worries Assange lawyers. A fear among the Assange legal team is that the British High Court of Justice may issue a final decision on the extradition and then the authorities could whisk him away to an airplane. He could be in transit to the US before his attorneys are notified of the outcome of the appeal and can appeal to the ECHR. Among other revelations, WikiLeaks has published video showing the killing of two Reuters journalists by U.S. military personnel, along with documents describing torture of detainees at U.S. military facilities in Iraq. While those revelations may seem somewhat historical at this point, other releases from WikiLeaks remain essential to recent news. This summer has been the 7 hottest days on record during a month that is poised to go down on the hottest in recorded history. According to WikiLeaks releases from 2016, the U.S. privately pressured Germany into dropping its demand for a 25% to 45% midterm carbon dioxide reduction in 2008, a move that almost certainly had an impact on the current climate emergency. While Assange is often described by colleagues as a difficult person to get along with and one increasingly prone to erratic behavior, his case could set a significant and dangerous precedent if his extradition is allowed to go through, free speech advocates from across the political spectrum argue. That's partially because of what's called the New York Times problem. Essentially, the worry that if the door to prosecution of journalists for dealing with secret but civically important information were to be spanned and opened by this case, it could never be shut, with future governments not hesitating to prosecute reporters for outlets like the New York Times if they published embarrassing stories. Similarly, problematic for Assange supporters, including many in the media who have also criticized him, is the assertion of universal jurisdiction by the United States. Gosler told Pointer in April, the effect of the U.S. or any other country claiming universal jurisdiction for prosecutions means that investigative journalism, particularly efforts to uncover crimes and abuses of power committed by military or security agencies, is endangered. Noting that other national governments could see an extradition as a green light to pursue their own draconian clampdowns on free speech in the name of national security. On the topic of national security, U.S. voices critical of Assange have often been outspoken, citing the idea that secret sources and operatives working for Americans in hostile territory have been put in danger by his publishing of the leaks. Asked to name a single person killed or injured by WikiLeaks publications, however, State Department spokesperson declined to comment, referring Truthout to a Justice Department spokesperson. The Justice Department spokesperson then declined to comment on the matter. If the U.S.-British allies attempt to prevent an ECHR appeal by shipping Assange immediately to the United States, after a British judgment, it would not be the first time an attempt has been made to do an end run around the Strasbourg court, according to reporting by Italian outlet Il Fatto Quotidiano, which found via Freedom of Information Act request that Swedish and British officials had tried to preempt a theoretical ECHR appeal in a Swedish investigation of potential misconduct by Assange that was later closed. The Home Office spokesperson told Truthout that this case is not about freedom of expression or a free press, which the UK unequivocally supports. Goslar says that simply not true, stating that the UK government does not unequivocally support freedom of expression or a free press. At a time when people in the UK are suffering due to record-breaking heat from climate change, the UK government has targeted environmental protesters with Public Order Act 2023. This bill was appropriately condemned by United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, Volker Turk, who condemned the deeply troubling legislation. Goslar cites the Index on Censorship, which assessed UK freedom of information and activism, and found that the country had dropped into the third tier globally in 2023. He wrote, "Many of the groups that pressured the UK government to successfully alter a national security bill to diminish its impacts on journalists are the same groups that say the extradition case against Julian Assange is absolutely about freedom of expression." He added, the UK government cannot have it both ways.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
In this program, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a part of a speech delivered by Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the veterans from the Sacred Defense and the Resistance Field. This meeting was held in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya on September 2023, inaugurating Sacred Defense Week. This revolution was able to remove the dependent corrupt system that was ruling the country and establish a new system and a new voice in its place, the Islamic Republic. Republic means democracy. Islamic means religion. Religious democracy was a new term in the world. We have had religious governments throughout history, but there was no talk of democracy in them. We have had democratic governments, real or fictitious, but there was no talk of religion in them. Never before had there been a government or a system in which religion and this world and the hereafter, the people and God were all involved and were the builders of it. But such a thing happened and they wanted to crush it. The enemies wanted to overcome it and eliminate the Islamic Republic. This was their target, and this has remained their target up until today. They come up with all different types of excuses, but as to those who are against the Islamic Republic, are opposing it, and are hostile toward it, their problems is with the Islamic Republic.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Other marginal issues are of less importance. This is their main issue, and it was back then as well. Of course, there was a wicked, greedy person such as Saddam in the midst of this who was far removed from any aspect of human decency. He had another goal as well, which was to destroy the Islamic Republic, to invade and assault the country's territorial integrity, to take the oil-rich regions of the country and to divide the country. These were his goals, but the other parties didn't care much about these things. Their main concern was that of the Islamic Republic. There is a big difference between a war that takes place with the aim of changing a part of the border between two countries and a war that takes place to destroy the thing that constitutes the identity of a nation.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.